You're listening to the IC interviews from the Investors Chronicle, and today our guest is Derek Leatherdale, who for more than a decade worked at HSBC, where he was based in the bank's government affairs division and set up the internal geopolitical risk team. He is currently a risk consultant at GRI Strategies, advising companies on geopolitical volatility. Derek, thanks very much for joining me. I wanted to start very simply. Can you briefly explain what people like you mean when they talk about geopolitical risk, and more specifically, what all of this means for ordinary investors?
Thanks very much, Alex, for the introduction, and delighted to join you. So I suppose one way of thinking about geopolitical risk is that it's sort of a thing, or people have often associated it in the past. It's a thing that sort of matters and is undertaken by governments. It's about intergovernmental relations. And I think for a long time, and certainly in the period immediately after the end of the Cold War, geopolitics was sort of thought of as something that was distinct and separate from business and business activity and global business activity. That, I think, started to change a number of years ago. And one of the reasons why I set up HSBC's geopolitical risk unit was because it was becoming apparent that geopolitics in various ways was starting to touch on the operations of HSBC globally. It was affecting the bank in different ways, sometimes through what is now described as financial risk, and equally sometimes through what is now described as non-financial risk. But there were various touch points and various impacts, and that equally that the broader geopolitical environment was one in which there was the possibility of developments, particularly in HSBC's case, in relation to the US-China relationship, that could potentially throw up some awkward strategic dilemmas for HSBC. Coming to the second part of your question, you know, what does this all mean for investors? Quite a number of things. But broadly, I mean, from an investment point of view, I think I would highlight two or three sort of quick high-level themes. One is that geopolitics is becoming more volatile, not less. That was happening before COVID, but COVID will certainly accelerate many of the sort of structural instabilities in the international political order. And it follows, I think, an increasing number of firms who operate globally in whatever sector will start to feel the impacts of that volatility. And that's sort of, in very broad terms, something that investors will need to be aware of. It sort of equally follows from that there will be some sectors which will be more effective than others. So the obvious one, I think, that people were pointing to even before COVID was technology and the possibility of US-China developments affecting the way technology companies are able to operate. And, you know, from an investment point of view, you know, that would have consequences for stock selection and more broadly across sort of asset class diversification. But equally, I think there are other sectors where there will be impacts in future, as well as, I think, perhaps in a more sort of classic sense, the possibility of greater levels of general market volatility that investors, I think, will now have to sort of, as it were, get used to and aim off for as a result of geopolitics.
Yeah, so I suppose there's the sectoral view, isn't there? And then there's also the market reaction view to geopolitics. I was really interesting, just to sort of track back a little bit to what you were saying about the broader framework of how we see geopolitics affecting both markets and the world. I suppose to many, the last four decades has been characterized by as an era of untrammeled growth, really, in what could roughly be termed global finance, I suppose, in which investors have increasingly instantaneous and broad access to different asset classes and markets around the world. And where at the same time, and facilitating that, we've got large financial groups with presence across all continents, able to do very complex transactional transactions around the world, and helping blue chips, particularly in the West, to expand their, you know, expand their horizon anywhere. Should we, I suppose this is tied to a question around globalization partly, but from a geopolitical risk perspective, should we expect this trend to end, or is it going to continue at a slower pace in the coming decades, do you feel?
I suspect it will. The pace of globalization and the globalization of economic and financial activity would probably slow broadly, but I would expect that to be somewhat uneven, and that there may be some geographies and some areas where a deceleration, if you like, is more pronounced. But I would sort of add this point that geopolitics do not necessarily represent an insuperable barrier to companies operating in the way that they have, but that probably the trick here is for those companies that wish to continue to operate business models on a global basis need to get better. They need to get smarter at anticipating geopolitical sort of pain points, if you like, and need to get better at thinking through in advance how to respond to those and how to navigate those. And tying this back to an investor perspective, I think one of the other things that the investment community will need to think about doing is being able more effectively to interrogate in invested companies on how they are approaching the new geopolitical environment in which we find ourselves.
Yeah, and I suppose, from a sort of investor framework perspective, one of the really important aspects of how, I suppose, companies communicate or fail to communicate their thinking around geopolitics is issues around timing and sort of time frames. Because, you know, in the abstract, I think it's easy to understand how, for example, geopolitical risk might have a direct impact on some market prices. Like, to take an example of the past couple of years, we've seen huge swings in oil prices related to, mm-hmm. you know, either brinksmanship between Iran and the US, or then market control battles between Russia and Saudi Arabia. And then before that, and I suppose it's not gone away, is the trade war between the US and China, which had, you know, large immediate effects on many commodities. But if you're an airline, for example, or a shipping business, those are the sort of geopolitical currents you have to live on. And if you're, so long as you're a company doing business in or with a specific country, that is presumably a risk-based calculation which you can all price in or hedge against. But it seems to me there's a more important question for investors about how fast geopolitical risks are liable to emerge. Is that a useful way of think about things more generally, aside from the specific spikes in volatility that is part of global affairs anyway?
The short answer, I think, is yes. So one of the features of the geopolitical landscape in which we find ourselves, I think perhaps underpinned by, for instance, the emergence of social media and new technology, is that geopolitics, sort of as it were, happens faster than perhaps it used to 20 or 30 years ago or longer, and that issues can arise, and sort of unpredictable actions by different capitals or different political figures can happen with probably less notice than might have been the case decades ago. For me, the conclusion from that point is that it's ever more important that companies operating globally in whatever sector try to think more actively in advance about how they can preserve value and value for shareholders in an environment of, if you like, not only higher volatility, but also higher volatility that happens more quickly. In a sense, the point about the timing and the tempo of this is that it makes it more important, not less, for companies to anticipate some of these issues even if in anticipation you can't anticipate perfectly what may happen, it is still possible to think through the broad currents and put in place some preparations and some, in the kind of jargon of this stuff, you know, put in place the right kind of risk management and risk mitigation. Yeah, and I would say investment managers should be doing the same. You know, that they've got their own risk management infrastructures, and they could and they should be using that more effectively on this agenda.
I suppose the question there is you can prepare for things, but is there actually anything that companies, and let's take for example companies of real scale with the ability to do this, with, you know, with lobbying power, for example, can they proactively manage geopolitical risk in 2020, i.e. are there channels for them to, I suppose, lobby on, you know, lobby governments directly to sort of bend the arc of whatever's coming next their way?
Yes and no. There are certainly channels, and as you mentioned in the introduction, I spent several years working in HSBC's group government affairs function. I think broadly there are some things which large companies can lobby on and lobby on quite effectively, typically sort of questions, say, of economic policy, of domestic economic policy or domestic regulation on the regulatory front. Large companies generally also try and lobby at the international standard setting level. The problem with geopolitics is that it's less prone, and governments in general are less likely to listen to lobbying when it comes to questions of what they perceive to be national security. And it sometimes actually the dynamic works the other way around, as we've seen in recent days with HSBC. It would appear from the media reporting that HSBC, as it were, was expected to indicate a degree of support for Beijing's wish to extend the national security law to Hong Kong. And that's not the kind of thing typically that you can lobby against as a large company, because it's just such a sensitive area of policy making in governments. I think the other thing around the lobbying question and bending the arc is typically lobbying teams in large companies are recruited from the domestic markets in which that particular business unit may be located. So, for instance, in the US, there is a very active lobbying scene by almost all major corporates across almost all sectors, but typically those lobbyists will be from the US political system or acquainted with the US political system. Their ability to go and lobby in Beijing is limited, going on non-existent. There's a sort of a strong national bias, if you like, to the extent to which lobbying can have an impact, and that, you know, all of that, it presupposes that lobbying is the only mitigant that firms can put in place. Actually, I think, and in my experience, the more effective mitigants come through internal activity that, for instance, would seek to understand how a geopolitical scenario might affect the balance sheet in a particular business unit, and then thinking about what can be done should the scenario materialize to ensure that the balance sheet is less affected. Or in banking terms, you know, banks can think about whether they need to change the structure of their corporate client books away from affected sectors and firms in affected sectors, or towards firms that they think might benefit from some of the geopolitical volatility that is now apparent. Broadly, I think there's much more on the what internal risk management and mitigation can be done to forestall the impacts of geopolitical volatility against the argument that says we can lobby our way out of this.
Well, that's really, really interesting. I suppose, you know, to take the converse, and I suppose at the plural of anecdote is not data or reality. The interesting to note, the reports in the Telegraph this weekend about HSBC again, apparently lobbying the government on behalf of Huawei and over the 5G matter, which I thought was another interesting spin in the the recent tale for HSBC. But,
yeah. Absolutely, fascinating. I saw those reports too.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe just staying with that, the US China theme or cleavage, because it's, I suppose, in geopolitical terms, it's going to be at the top of the, I suppose, the risk agenda for many large companies and how investors think about geopolitical risk more generally. So, I mean, some people think we're on the brink or may already be in a new kind of cold war between the US and China. And I mean, you mentioned at the top that COVID-19, has the capacity to, potentially accelerate this and other geopolitical risks at the moment. So, I mean, specifically, if we are in an increasingly fraught, polarized world with the US and China, the two great powers, what does that geopolitical risk involved in all of that mean for your average blue chip company with either global ambitions or a multi-continental presence? And I suppose specifically thinking about UK companies and, European companies and UK investors, where do they fit into this worldview? Because in many senses, you're caught between these two poles.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, to the first point that you raised, Alex, are we already in or on the verge of a new kind of cold war with capital C, capital W? I'm not sure that is a more semantic than perhaps a more theoretical discussion that doesn't necessarily help advance kind of practical realities. I think it's just probably the key point is that given how the China narrative is playing out in the US amongst both the political or amongst political figures in the US and amongst public opinion, I think it's inconceivable that the US will come to a more relaxed posture on China anytime soon, and that's really, I think, regardless of who wins the presidential election in November. You can sort of drill into that in other ways. Trump is, I think, going to campaign hard on an even more stridently anti-China narrative, because it's one of the things that he would regard as helping him try and overcome what are at the moment not great polls for him and his prospects. But equally, I think on the Chinese side, it would appear there is an emerging sense that now is the time to start challenging the US in a perhaps a slightly more overt way than had been the case hitherto. And there may be a mixture of reasons for that. So broadly speaking, I think the point here is that whether it's a cold war or not a cold war or whatever other label, I think we are moving into a phase of more intense US-China competition, more intense US-China mistrust. And that will play out across a number of issues as we've seen it play out in respect of Hong Kong over the last sort of 10 days or so with the US declaration or the US State Department's declaration that in their view, China is no longer upholding the one country, two systems approach. But there are a myriad of other, possible sort of interfaces of tension in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, and military activity that goes on in both of those theatres. As well as in things like, in particular industry sectors. So Huawei is the obvious one, tech, comms, and all of that. What does that mean for UK businesses and UK investors? I think in part it means that if they are aiming to operate in a way that sort of cuts across those divisions, then at the very least they need to be pretty savvy about what that external risk environment looks like and how it's evolving, and B, need to think through what possible impacts there might be if that tension gets worse. On the back of that, then perhaps think about what sort of, if you like, mitigation or what contingency planning they would need to have in place. I think there's a sort of a more detailed set of considerations for investors, particularly where they're investing across asset classes, across geographies, across different types of industry sectors. The way investment managers use their existing risk infrastructure to manage this, I think will be really key to preserving value, and certainly minimizing, if you like, the hit from any future market volatility.
I know, I'm conscious you're not an investment manager, Derek, but I suppose the follow-up question here would be, is there, you know, investors almost in a slightly better position in that, assuming the investment channels through which they are able to invest offer exposure to both both a sort of a China-dominated sector or economy, and also a US one, that they are able to, in a sense, hedge their bets against these two worlds, where actually the reality for some companies in the coming decade may be they're having to actually pick a side in those mitigation efforts that you mentioned.
Yes, I mean, I mean, in a sense, that's the value of, from an asset management or investment management point of view, that's the value of diversification, that you don't have to put all of your eggs in one basket, and you can maybe balance off risk in different parts of one's portfolio. It may be a bit more complicated than that. I think that the US are considering measures that would potentially circumscribe the ability of US asset managers to invest in some Chinese economic sectors and firms. I think there are also some consideration is being given to measures that would potentially reduce the number of Chinese firms that list on US markets. And I could see that kind of logic being extended to, if not directly or in as intense a way, that kind of logic being extended either sort of de facto or de jure to other Western capitals and the way investment practices are allowed to operate. So I think there's a sort of a strain of actually governments. In this new era, governments, but particularly the US, may actually take active measures that circumscribe what asset managers can do in respect of trying to invest both sides of this divide. In that sense, it may become very difficult to try and play both sides of the fence, or at least more difficult. But again, I think that's where the value of, from an investment management point of view, the value of diversification, the value of being able to operate across asset classes, across geographies is probably right. And there's also that point that I think there are some opportunities. You know, there will be companies who can actually thrive in this environment. You know, the cliche that people often mention, but I still think it's right, is that there will be companies that are able to help firms relocate their supply chains. So where a large firm, say a tech firm, has got a supply chain that starts in China and ends in the US, you know, that may cease to become tenable in this sort of new era. So the firm in question may look to relocate the start of their supply chain to Vietnam, for instance. And I think there are opportunities for organizations that can help them do that, like, for instance, some banks will be able to profit from that move.
Interesting stuff. So potentially there is a role for finance and logistics across this this troubling new world. Derek, let's leave it there. Thanks so much for your time. It was really, really good to speak to you as ever.